have no paper backup?
Yeah, well, the two that would be of particular concern, because they're swing states in the election, is Pennsylvania and Virginia. Some of the others, Tennessee, are you know, probably pretty locked in on who they're going to vote for. But I can tell you that this is being taken seriously in those states. I talked to Pennsylvania officials for this piece. They're very aware of these vulnerabilities. I mean, one thing that, you know, one, you know, obvious step is to make sure the machines are not connected to the internet, you know, in and around the time of voting. But at some point, they have to be turned on, and, you know, they do have to be connected. And that's, you know, a sophisticated hacker could theoretically get in and somehow tamper with the tabulations.
So, Michael, you have the FBI saying they've uncovered evidence that foreign hackers penetrated two state election systems. But, of course, it doesn't just have to be foreign hackers.
Right. It could be anybody. And look, there is, you know, on both sides, there is heightened awareness and concern about this. You have Donald Trump talking about rigged elections, and then on the other hand, you have Democrats like Harry Reid, who wrote a letter to FBI Director Comey yesterday after my piece, raising concerns about Russian tampering, and given the associations that people in the Trump campaign have had with Russia. Paul Manafort, of course, was in business with pro-Putin oligarchs. Mike Flynn, the general, retired general, had flown over to Moscow for the 10th anniversary celebration of RT and was paid for it. So there's been multiple
an advisor to Donald Trump. And you have Donald Trump talking about rigged elections. On the other hand, what was your response to him calling on Russia to hack Hillary Clinton's emails?
Yeah, well, clearly that caught a lot of attention and seemed way over the top. Of course, he said he was only being sarcastic and shouldn't be taken seriously. But I think, look, you know, can the Russians actually launch a full-scale cyber attack and influence the election? You know, probably not. As I mentioned, there are points of vulnerability, but it would take a lot, given that elections are state and local affairs, and there's a lot of points of entry, and it would be a huge undertaking. But even if they could do a little bit, do something like what they did, like
Michael,
the tampering with
elections. Michael Esikoff, we're going to have to leave it there. Chief Investigator Correspondent for Yahoo News. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tony Ozier and the Doodoo Funk All-Stars are teaming up with Cable Community Radio and Audio Globe for another installment of the Dookie Jam. That's September 1st at 10 p.m. at Dante's at 350 West Burnside in downtown Portland. Audio Globe is an audiovisual recording company that specializes in high-fidelity capture and streaming services, providing global reach to regional and national artists on audioglobe.com. The Dookie Jam brings together some of the region's best funk, soul, rock, R&B, and jazz musicians to jam one night a month live at Dante's. The Dookie Jam is happening September 1st, 10 p.m., and we'll be streaming live on KBOO.FM and audioglobe.com.
Join KBOO Community Radio at Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, September the 8th for United We Stand Up, a comedy show and a benefit for KBOO. I'm T6, and I'll be your host that night, which will feature local comedians like Betty Lungen, Bree Pruitt, Adam Potsy, Brandy Morgan, Belinda Giles, Noriko Ott, and Debbie Wooten. Raffles, refreshments, and good times for all. Again, that's United We Stand Up, Thursday, September the 8th, at Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Doors at 6:30, showcase at 7:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 5:03 p.m. And up next is your evening news. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales and the City Council will consider his proposal to extend the city's housing emergency by 1 year tomorrow.
Willamette River Keepers, Travis Williams will be live in our studio to discuss Portland's Superfund sites.
And we'll also speak with KABU's own Dime Roberts about her new stage show, What Are You? A Mixed Race Reading and Talk. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, August 30th, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Charlie Hales is expected to propose extending Portland's housing emergency status for another year at a hearing to convene at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Originally, Hales wanted a 3-year extension, but reduced that to 1 year following disapproval by all four city council members. The original housing emergency enacted last year is set to expire on October 7th. Meanwhile, the much-anticipated sweep of homeless camps on the Springwater Corridor, pushed back 1 month already, is set to take place this Thursday, September 1st. Some of the hundreds of campers on the corridor are believed to have already relocated to various different locations, while others are expected to engage in civil resistance with the help of local activists. Also, in housing-related news, a state administrative law judge has blocked the Right to Dream 2 houseless camp from moving to the East Side Industrial District. The City of Portland officials broke zoning rules by proposing residential use in an industrial area, was the ruling this afternoon by the State Land Use Board of Appeals. The city has said that Right to Dream had to move by October 31st, and now the process is essentially back to the drawing board. Stay tuned to KABU for more on this breaking news story.
Reports saying that the state of Washington is poised to eradicate an entire wolf pack might not be accurate. The Seattle Times reported last week that the Washington Fish and Wildlife was set to kill the entire Profanity Peak wolf pack to keep safe a flock of sheep in a rugged area of the state. But KABU News spoke with the environmental organization Conservation Northwest, which is working together with Wolf Haven International, the Humane Society of the United States, and Defenders of Wildlife. They say that while the state has been authorized to kill the pack, the story has been widely misreported. KABU's Lisa Loving interviewed Chase Gunnell of Conservation Northwest about what's really going on with the wolves.
It's not yet clear that this entire wolf pack will be removed. The state of Washington has never before removed an entire wolf pack. There have been incidents where members of packs have been lethally removed in instances of livestock conflict, including in 2012 and in 2014. But in both those cases, the wolf pack was not removed, and the wedge pack, which was the first of those two cases, is still a functioning wolf pack in our state. It's very likely that it will be incredibly difficult to remove the entire Profanity Peak pack, and perhaps the department will not follow through with doing so, simply because of the ruggedness of terrain and the looming end of the livestock grazing season. So while these incidents are ongoing, I don't think it's accurate at this point to say that the entire pack will be removed for sure.
What's currently happening with this case?
Yeah, well, I can give you a brief overview. Washington State is an area that has been having wolves return to it for about a decade now, and our state has tried to learn from experiences of places like the Rocky Mountains and Canada and Alaska, where wolves have been coming back or have been existing for many more years than Washington and other areas of the Pacific Northwest have experienced. It's important to us to learn from those experiences, those policies, those conservation strategies to inform our own. And one of the things we've learned is that social tolerance and coexistence is vital for long-term wolf recovery. You cannot have sustained wolf recovery without it. We want our state to be a place where wolf populations flourish, and so do rural communities, and so do other populations of native wildlife. And in order to have that, particularly the long-term sustained and durable recovery of wolves, there must be tolerance for wolves within communities, particularly rural communities, where wolves live. And to ensure that, wolves that habitually depredate on livestock, including, an example, this case of Fandy Pack, after non-lethal preventative measures have been tried, and if those measures fail, one of the key elements of maintaining social tolerance for wolves in rural communities is removing those problem wolves that are habitually depredating on livestock. It's tremendously sad. We hate to see it. It's never something that we want to come to this, but it is a necessary element to maintain that tolerance. And that tolerance promotes coexistence, and coexistence allows the long-term recovery of these important species in our region.
How did this case come about, Chase? What's the history?
Yeah, so I would start with saying about a year ago, in accordance with our state's Wolf Conservation and Management Plan, which a number of conservation groups, including Conservation Northwest and other groups, helped the state adopt. The state set about creating a wolf advisory group, sort of a citizens' input panel that could represent a number of different stakeholders, from environmentalists to animal rights groups like the Humane Society of the United States, to wildlife conservation groups like Conservation Northwest, to hunting and ranching organizations, really a roundtable of people and stakeholders that are impacted by the return of this native species. And we need to sit down at the table and find ways to set management policies that are guided by collaboration and compromise. And that Wolf Advisory Group went about adopting a protocol for when wolf depredations do become habitual or become a pattern. And in that case, the protocol, through much deliberation and much collaboration and much compromise, was agreed that if the rancher involved or the livestock producer or farmer involved did use preventative measures such as cowboys, we often call them range riders, or guard dogs, or other non-lethal preventative measures, that wolf pack would then, as a last resort, as a necessary evil, be removed. And while that is, again, tremendously sad, it is the agreement that that group reached through compromise. It was agreed to by many different parties, including animal rights organizations and environmental groups. And we, again, believe it's necessary for coexistence and long-term wolf recovery.
Okay, as we have read some stories in the Seattle Times, they seem to be setting it up as like a white hat, black hat conflict, and they're talking about a little bit what the rancher has or has not done in terms of this particular Profanity Peak wolf pack situation.
The information alleged in that Seattle Times article is not consistent with the information we've been receiving from sources on the ground and the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. And there's some investigations ongoing right now about whether the rancher did place his cows near the den or whether it was up to 5 or more miles away, which is what we've heard, and what sort of non-lethal measures were used at that time to help deter wolf packs. We're waiting for some of that information, but at this point, what we read in that article is not consistent with the facts that we've been told.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The protest on the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota continues. Over 2,000 people have joined the protest, which is calling for a halt to the $3.8 million Dakota Access Pipeline. Earth Justice filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, calling for a preliminary injunction on the pipeline, claiming that the Army Corps of Engineers failed to adequately survey the land before giving approval of the pipeline. As tribal members enter into their fifth month of protesting the pipeline, activists and supporters are attempting to find ways to block the construction of the 1,100-mile pipeline. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with activist Ed Fallon, who has been covering the protest at Standing Rock.
Well, there's been so many things happening, it's hard to know where to start. But landowners have filed a lawsuit to stop the pipeline from using eminent domain. The law seems pretty clear that they should not be able to come through private land for a private purpose. So that lawsuit, unfortunately, some of the rulings have been going against us, but it's still a live round. But we're not waiting for that to be decided. Tomorrow, there will probably be over 100 people who are going onto the pipeline site and engaging in a nonviolent training session, and that will be followed up with direct action, where we physically try to stop construction from happening. Now, in response to that, the pipeline company has threatened to file a restraining order against me, as me and also my organization, Bold Iowa, and they've also threatened to file that against another activist who's been leading the charge. So, you know, they're just trying to silence dissent. They just want people to shut up and go away, And they've used their power and their money all along to push people around. And, you know, landowners and farmers and our tribal allies and environmental community aren't backing down. We're standing strong. We don't believe this is a legal use of eminent domain. We don't believe this pipeline has a right to take our farm ground. And we know it's going to cause climate damage. We know it's going to eventually cause water damage. And we want to continue to do everything we can to stop it.
Yeah, it seems to be from so many points of view, virtually everyone involved, the tribal leaders, the Dakota, Sioux, and now, as I understand, many other nations are represented, many other tribes are all convening at Sacred Stone Camp in support of those who are protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, which gives people a ready-made forum, an opportunity to talk about excesses on the part of private interests all across the country, where tribal land has been desecrated, and treaties have been broken, and
one of the great things about this movement that's happening is it's a very powerful alliance of tribal communities and farmers and landowners who, you know, for many years and certainly a long time ago might have been at odds, but we're all on the same page now. We're all fighting to defend the same land, the same water, the same rights. And it's very encouraging to see the strong presence that has gathered in North Dakota. There are now over 100 tribes represented at the Spirit Camp. And, you know, again, we have the same kind of momentum here in Iowa as well. And again, we have some tribal allies in our state as well, but most of the momentum here has been coming from farmers and landowners. And so it's exciting to see that coming together of those two different communities.
Sure. What could be more American? You know, apple pie and farmers in Iowa. This is now they've really stepped in it. There's still, I think, from our perspective out here, there's so little coverage. The effort to suppress this all news coming out of this area has been the most obvious. What about communications in and out of Sacred Stone Camp? Do you have any?
Well, I've got to run after this question.
Yes,
I'm afraid,
sorry.
But I don't know what the status of that is. I have not been to the camp yet myself. It's about a 12-hour drive from where I'm at in Iowa. But what I hear is that they're still finding ways of getting information out to the public. But Dakota Access, the pipeline company, is trying to suppress dissent in every way possible. You know, up there they had the county sheriff close the road to the Spirit Camp, but people have found another way to get there. Here they're trying to put restraining orders on me and on Bold, Iowa. So, but, you know, this is a really historic moment because the tribes have never come together like this. Last time they came together like this was the Battle of Wounded Knee. And, you know, in Iowa, we haven't seen landowners and farmers stand together like this since the Iowa farm crisis back in the 1980s. So what's happening is pretty historic. And don't go away. We're not done yet. So, you know, we're going to keep fighting this, and we'll keep you posted. But I've got to run now to a meeting.
Okay, thank you so much, Ed. We really appreciate your time. We're speaking with Ed Fallon, the Fallon Forum and Bold, Iowa. Two sources to follow to get news coming directly from those who are on the front lines of the effort to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline.
That was activist Ed Fallon speaking on Air Cascadia this morning with KBOO's Chris Andre.
The window for public input into the massive Willamette River cleanup is rapidly closing. The EPA is attempting to lead this cleanup agreement that was hammered out with polluters over a 16-year period. Local organizations concerned for the health of the river are pushing for the best cleanup possible. Here to tell us more is the leader of the Willamette River Keeper, Travis Williams. Welcome, Travis.
Thank you.
So first, can you just give us a little bit of background? What is the Portland Harbor Superfund site?
Well, the Superfund site extends from roughly the Fremont Bridge on the east side all the way down to near the confluence with the Columbia River. So about 11 miles of river there that has a combination of contaminated riverside lands, But almost more importantly than that, contaminants that have made their way over many decades into the river itself, and they're on the river bottom in the sediments. And in many cases, those contaminants, which include PCBs, the breakdown products of DDT, which was manufactured along the river there, oil-based contaminants and others, including dioxin, have imbued a lot of those sediments very deeply in some cases. And the reason this matters is that those contaminants, that those pollutants, can have a direct impact on the health of fish and a variety of wildlife, as well as people who consume certain species of resident fish. So back in 2000, when the EPA recognized the level of pollution in that stretch of the Willamette River, they invoked the Superfund Law, as it is commonly known, which began a process to figure out what those contaminants are, where they go, how they interact with each other, and a lot of other variables, and then formulating some steps to reduce the risk from those contaminants.
So who are all the players involved in this cleanup then?
The players are pretty diverse. The law compels people who have liability, companies typically, who have some connection to the original pollution to take part in the cleanup process. So in our case, there's a whole host of large companies and small ones, as well as the City of Portland and the Port of Portland, two public entities. The Department of Defense will be on the hook at some point as well because of the shipbuilding and the deconstruction of those ships that was done over the years. And all of those entities collectively, if they have liability, they have to contribute to the cleanup process in some way. That will be figured out after the US EPA issues its record of decision, which is, in essence, the final cleanup plan.
Well, can we talk a little bit about the EPA? What is their role in all of this? I guess there's questions about the DEQ versus the EPA, and what different roles do those two organizations play in this?
Yeah. Before I get to that, what I failed to mention, though, is that where we are in the timeline. So it started out in 2000. It took 15 years for the EPA to work with, and many times those relationships were difficult to move things forward with some of the local companies here, but to work with those entities to develop what they call the draft cleanup plan. And that came out in June 8th, and that opened up a public comment process. And this is really critical. So that allows anybody who has an interest in this cleanup, making the Willamette and all of those species cleaner, reducing cancer risk to people, to chime in on this draft plan and write to EPA or go to a website that has a ready-made way to communicate with the EPA to tell them, here's what we think of your plan. And when we saw that plan, along with many other organizations, we really thought it was a far cry from what they should be implementing. If you look at what they propose, are alternatives from A to H, I believe, and the one they chose is I. It doesn't do enough. It doesn't dredge enough of the contaminated sediment off the river bottom. That's principally the way you get rid of that waste permanently from the river environment. So what we're calling for is option G, alternative G. And this is stated in multiple places. But the point here is that people can write the EPA and say, you are not proposing enough contaminated sediment to be dredged. We would like you to do more. Choose option G. And there's a variety of ways to go about that. And they have until September 6th, next Tuesday, 5 p.m. This is it. We're into the final week of this. It can take 5 minutes to get on a website. We have one called cleanupportlandharbor.org. That was developed by the Yakima Nation, who are partners in this effort to clean up Portland Harbor. It's a great site. And when you utilize that site, it sends a message to our congressional representatives in the city of Portland as well. You can look at Willamette Riverkeeper site under Superfund. We also have all of the contact information there for people to utilize. But this is critical. This is it. If you've lived in Portland any amount of time, you've probably heard about this contaminated stretch of river. If we get a lot of people writing in to say, EPA, you're not doing enough in this draft plan, please, when you put out your final plan, propose more sediment to be dredged and other options to reduce that risk.
This might be a more politically tinged question, but why do you think it is that the EPA is trying to clean less up off the bottom of the river?
I think it's just there are some people there who feel that maybe that's all some of the local companies will do. maybe that's all they will accept. I tend to think they are also trying to make an argument based on the toxicology. What we and the community of people who are very knowledgeable about this cleanup and others who are have consultants like Willamette Riverkeeper employs a consultant on behalf of the community have really looked at this plan and find major deficiencies in it. So that is all going to be communicated to EPA Region 10 by next Tuesday. So hopefully the EPA will look at that and say, all right, we'll make these adjustments to this plan. There has been a lot of political pressure as well on that agency and a lot of narratives that have been spun about it. And I think maybe they've succumbed to that pressure a little bit as well. So collectively, there's a range of organizations and people who are pushing back. And again, the way we can all push back is by commenting by next Tuesday at 5 p.m.
We're talking about this pushback from what I'm assuming would be the people who are responsible for the pollution. Why is there this massive pushback? Besides, you know, financial reasons that people don't want to, is it so much that they're saying that they're not responsible? Because I know that one thing I have heard an argument as well, the sediment and the pollution goes back for so long. How can you pinpoint who is responsible? So how is the EPA and the DEQ, how are they going about figuring out who is actually responsible for what?
Mm-hmm. In most cases, what they've done is they look at the historical record of the property use. And in many instances, it's really easy to tell where the pollution came from and who generated it. Superfund, like any law, is not a perfect law, but this is what we're stuck with. So if you purchased a property 20 years ago and didn't do your due diligence, you still own the pollution that's in that property and it becomes your responsibility. So that's one of the things about this law that some people don't like. But frankly, it's no different if you purchased a residential property that had a leaky oil tank and you didn't have that inspected before you purchased it. Same deal.
The polluters, they're threatening a lawsuit if the EPA doesn't back down. Is that an actual libel threat that could actually happen?
In my understanding, and also talking with lawyers who've worked a lot on this issue, there really isn't much recourse after EPA comes out with its final cleanup plan, which we expect in December. They would like to get it done in the Obama administration, but it could go into the next administration. When EPA issues that plan, they go into a process called allocation. So all of these different entities who have some legal liability for the cleanup negotiate with each other about who does what and or who pays what. If work doesn't proceed, EPA has the legal authority to compel specific entities to do work or groups of entities. So when I see in print in different articles that some people are making claims about a lot of legal disputes, if it's related to the content of this record of decision and the final cleanup plan, they don't really have a lot to go on there. So I don't know. We'll see, but hopefully we won't get to that point. My hope is that there will be members of the community, which include the Port of Portland, Northwest Natural, big utility who has fought this thing in different ways for a long time, the Port of Portland, the City of Portland, that collectively those entities will work together and say, okay, we're going to do the right thing for the river. We're going to make progress on this cleanup. We're going to remove more sediment than the original plan prescribed.
Well, you know, we're almost running out of time here, so I want to make sure that we get that information out again about the public comment. How can people make public comment to the EPA again?
So you can make public comment by going on the EPA Region 10 Portland Harbor site, if you wanted to Google that. An easier way is simply to go to cleanupportlandharbor.org, and that'll take you to a ready-made form where you can also input your specific comments in addition to some narrative that's already there, pushing for Alternative G. You could also look at WillametteRiverkeeper.org and our Superfund section there.
And how long do they have to make comment?
5 p.m. on September 6th, so next Tuesday. So if we could generate an additional push in this last week, it's really going to do a lot for the river.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. We're just all out of time.
You're welcome.
So that was Travis Williams of the Willamette Riverkeeper. You can find out more about them at www.willamette-riverkeeper.org or find them on Facebook and Twitter at Willamette Riverkeeper. Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers created a stir in the football world with his refusal to stand during the national anthem at a game in Santa Clara last Friday. Kaepernick set up the anthem in protest over rampant institutionalized racism in society. The athlete explained that, quote, "I am not going to stand up to show pride and a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color," end quote. He also said that he issues a protest are, quote, "bigger than football." Kaepernick has received criticism as well as support following his actions. In light of Kaepernick's actions, many in support of him have been pointing out to a sentiment once expressed by famed baseball player Jackie Robinson, who stated in his 1972 autobiography that, quote, "I cannot stand and sing the anthem. I cannot salute the flag. I know that I am a black man in a white world. In 1972 and 1947, at my birth in 1919, I know that I have never made it."
Cafe Smoothie fans might want to be careful about strawberries for a while. KBOO's Jermani Ward-Lewis explains why.
Today, the Associated Press reported that Virginia health officials say that there are now 40 confirmed cases of hepatitis A that are connected to frozen strawberries used at Tropical Smoothie Cafe locations across the state, up from 28 cases less than a week ago. The Virginia Department of Health said in a news release Monday that about 55% of the infected residents have been hospitalized. There are more than 500 of the smoothie franchises across the country, and Virginia is not the only state affected. All the potentially contaminated Egyptian-sourced berries were pulled from the 96 Tropical Smoothie Cafe locations in Virginia no later than August 8th or August 9th. Officials say more cases could emerge since some symptoms take as many as 50 days to emerge. For KBOO News, I'm Jermani Ward-Lewis.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth with an interview with KBOO's own DMA Roberts at 5:45, followed by Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Willamette Valley will be cloudy with showers in the afternoon and late evening. East of the Cascades and Hood River, skies will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of shower during the day and cloudy skies at night. Today in history, in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was confirmed as a justice of the Supreme Court, making him the first African-American to hold that position. The quote of the day is from Justice Marshall, who said, quote, "In recognizing the humanity of our fellow beings, we pay ourselves the highest tribute."
Today, President Obama commuted the sentences of over 100 federal inmates. The majority of inmates granted a commutation were serving time for nonviolent drug offenses, many serving life sentences. President Obama has commuted over 300 sentences during August, making it the largest amount of commutations granted during a single month by any president. According to the White House's blog, nearly 700 commutations granted by President Obama amounted to more commutations than the last 10 presidents combined. President Obama has expressed the need for commutations in order to bring attention to the need for reform in the justice system.
The Kurdish fighters in northern Syria have or have not reached a ceasefire with rebel groups backed by Turkey, depending on who you ask. Either way, the U.S. State Department declared that fighting between the two factions has temporarily stopped, which is the outcome sought by the United States. Turkey has supported actions by its own military and favored rebels against the mainly Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, since Turkey first committed ground troops to the northern theater of Syria's civil war last week. The SDF has claimed that a formal ceasefire is in place, but Turkish-backed rebels with the Free Syrian Army denied this, calling it nothing more than a pause. A Turkish foreign ministry spokesman did not confirm or deny a formal ceasefire. Turkey regards the SDF Kurdish fighters as terrorists and does not condone negotiations with them. Both Turkey and the U.S. insist that the Kurds withdraw east of the Euphrates, giving up territory that recently they won from the Islamic State group. Many Kurds regard this as another in a long line of betrayals by the U.S., since the Kurds have for years been the main force fighting IS on the ground in both Syria and Iraq.
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I'm going to read an excerpt from an August 24th op-ed in the New York Times titled "Taking a Stand at Standing Rock," written by the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, David Archambault II. Here's the op-ed. It's a spectacular sight. Thousands of Indians camped on the banks of the Cannonball River on the edge of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Our elders of the Seven Council Fires, as the Osseti Sakowin, or Great Sioux Nation, is known, sit in deliberation and prayer awaiting a federal court decision on whether construction of a $3.7 billion oil pipeline from the Bakken region to southern Illinois will be halted. The Sioux tribes have come together to oppose this project, which was approved by the state of North Dakota and the United States Army Corps of Engineers. The nearly 1,200-mile pipeline owned by a Texas oil company named Energy Transfer Partners would snake across our treaty lands and through our ancestral burial grounds. Just a half mile from our reservation boundary, the proposed route crosses the Missouri River, which provides drinking water for millions of Americans and irrigation water for thousands of acres of farming and ranching lands. Our tribe has opposed the Dakota Access Pipeline since we first learned about it in 2014. Although federal law requires the Corps of Engineers to consult with the tribe about its sovereign interests, permits for the project were approved and construction began without meaningful consultation. The Dakota Access Route is only a few miles shorter than what was proposed for the Keystone XL project. Yet the government's environmental assessment addressed only the portion of the pipeline route that traverses federal land. In recent weeks, the state of North Dakota has militarized my reservation with roadblocks and license plate checks, low-flying aircraft, and racial profiling of Indians. The local sheriff and the pipeline company have both called our protest unlawful, and Governor Dalrymple has declared a state of emergency. It's a familiar story in Indian country. This is the third time that the Sioux Nation's lands and resources have been taken without regard for tribal interests. The Sioux peoples signed treaties in 1851 and 1868. The government broke them before the ink was dry. When the Army Corps of Engineers dammed the Missouri River in 1958, it took our riverfront forests, fruit orchards, and most fertile farmland to create Lake Oahe. Now the Corps is taking our clean water and sacred places by approving this river crossing. Whether it's gold from the Black Hills or hydropower from the Missouri or oil pipelines that threaten our ancestral inheritance, the tribes have always paid the price for America's prosperity. The Indian encampment on the Cannonball grows daily, with nearly 90 tribes now represented. Our hand continues to be open to cooperation, and our cause is just. This fight is not just for the interests of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, but also for those of our neighbors on the Missouri River. The ranchers and farmers and small towns who depend on the river have shown overwhelming support for our protest. As American citizens, we all have a responsibility to speak for a vision of the future that is safe and productive for our grandchildren. We are a peaceful people, and our tribal council is committed to nonviolence. It's our constitutional right to express our views and take this stand at the Cannonball Camp. Yet the Lieutenant Governor of North Dakota, Drew Wrigley, has threatened to use his power to end this historic, peaceful gathering. We're also a resilient people who have survived unspeakable hardships in the past, so we know what is at stake now. As our songs and prayers echo across the prairie, we need the public to see that in standing up for our rights, we do so on behalf of the millions of Americans who will be affected by this pipeline. As one of our greatest leaders, Chief Sitting Bull of the Hump Papa Lakota, once said, quote, "Let us put our minds together and see what life we can make for our children," unquote. That appeal is as relevant today as it was more than a century ago. I've been reading an excerpt from an August 24th op-ed in the New York Times titled "Taking a Stand at Standing Rock," written by the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, David Archambault II. You can read the entire op-ed online. To continue following this fast-breaking story, check out IndianCountryTodayMediaNetwork.com. And to support this ongoing nonviolent direct action by a growing number of Native tribes, call the North Dakota governor and demand that his state police stand down and spread the word on social media. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the Cable Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
One of the most beloved community leaders in Portland history has died. Pastor Mary Overstreet Smith was a co-founder of the North by Northeast Community Health Clinic, and for many years, the pastor of Powerhouse Temple Church of God in Christ on North Williams Avenue. After Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, Pastor Mary actually sold her house to help victims from Texas and Louisiana relocate to Portland. Throughout her decades as a church leader, she was one of the few female religious leaders in Oregon who regularly traveled to prisons to offer spiritual guidance to incarcerated people. For nearly a quarter of a century, Pastor Mary hosted a cable television program called Harvest Time Ministries. In 2006, Pastor Mary's autistic great-grandson, Sir Millage, was shot at and beaten by Portland police. May responded by opening Portland's first day center for autistic adults. She's enshrined in Portland State University Walk of Heroines, which details her educational achievement, including an honorary doctorate of divinity, associate's degree in criminal justice, social work and nursing, a BS in criminal justice, and a certificate in pharmacology. Mary Overstreet Smith is survived by 14 children, of whom 8 were adopted or fostered, 16 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Longshanks, Sam Bowman, Emery Mort, and Al Kahn. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO Evening at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland interviews mayoral candidate and urban planning activist Sarah Iannarone, Amanda Reese of Backpackers of Hope, and Austin Rose of Portland Tenants United. They'll talk about the city council's discussion on extending their declared housing emergency, the Springwater Corridor houseless camp sweeps, and the Terminal 1 shelter proposal, and more. And 9 Political Perspectives features an interview with Kevin Anderson, professor, climate change researcher. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Radio Zine, host Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher speaks with Patty Lyons of NAMI, Multnomah, and Jackie Paris and Avi Klepper of Playback Theater about their interactive theater production, Break the Silence, Break the Stigma. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Night, Kanan.
Night, Jenna. Night, Wesley.
Good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're not going to sleep just yet. KBOO producer and author Dime Roberts has spent years creating dialogues as well as theater around race and racial issues. Her new show hits very close to home for many Portlanders. It's this Thursday night, and it's called What Are You? A Mixed Race Reading and Talk. Dime, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, hello. It's nice to see you, Kanan. I actually just want to say it's a reading and a talk about my book, The Letting Go Trilogy, Stories of a Mixed Race Family. And it's not really a show. We'll be talking, we'll be reading, but thanks for the plug. Yeah, another read-through bookstore is a great place.
Cool. Thank you for setting it straight. So First, what impelled you to do this reading in particular?
Well, I published this book, The Letting Go Trilogies. It was a culmination of about more than 10 years worth of writing that I've done and radio documentaries that I've produced, most of which have been personal in nature and about my family and my heritage and my race. And I, at one point last year, I decided, well, you know, I'd like to put them all into one collection. And so I applied for and got a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council, and I was able to hire an editor, a couple of editors actually, and formatter and be able to self-publish it. And so the idea was that it was first going to be just a collection of all these essays that I've written, many of which have been published in other publications, but then the editors urged me to create more of a through line, so it's more of a memoir, and it's a set of three stories each, hence the trilogies. And the stories are centered around my identity, around each of my family members, and also about Taiwan, of all things, because of my connection as a Taiwanese American there.
So I'm frequently asked this, being of mixed race myself, but can you explain the title of your...
What are you?
Yeah,
yeah, well, see, I think that you probably are asked that quite often, and it's that question that you are asked that you have to ponder a lot of times. So I write a little bit of sort of fun dialogue about that and all the what happens afterwards when you say what you are. You get a lot of interrogations. I call them interrogations about race. It's like, oh, you can't be this, but which side, which part? You know, is it your mom, your dad? You must take after them or this. And you get, it's almost like you have to defend yourself. It's like, no, I really am Asian. Yeah, I'm also white, you know. I'm also Taiwanese. I'm also, you know, Chinese, you know. I'm also all these other things. And you end up having to defend yourself. So I do it kind of a fun thing, and I end up calling myself Secret Asian Woman. So I'm Secret Asian Woman, and I have to break my cover a lot of times for people. And when I do, I get interrogated. And so I kind of throw it back, you know. I throw it back to, well, what are you, you know? Well, I'm just white. Well, not really. You know, there must have been some mixtures in there, right? Because you're Euro-American. So mm-hmm. let's investigate that. So I think the more people investigate their own heritage, and many people do. I mean, you know, the whole ancestry.com thing is big right